supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Support for Voices in the Family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
Today's Voices in the Family was pre-recorded.
Welcome to Voices in the Family. I'm Maiken Scott, in for Dan Gottlieb today. In cities like Philadelphia, Camden, or Chester, shootings and stabbings are so commonplace they barely make the news. Many of the victims are young men from poor, drug-infested neighborhoods. Emergency room staff attends to their wounds, and once their physical wounds are healed, they return to their neighborhoods, where violence is ever present. But what about their emotional wounds? When Dr. John Rich was working at Boston City Hospital, he began to reach out to young victims while they were in the hospital. He learned about their lives, their needs, and he recognized how little was done to address the effects of trauma. Today, Rich and several colleagues at Drexel University's Center for Nonviolence and Social Justice run a program called Healing Hurt People that reaches out to young victims and provides support. John Rich joins us today on Voices in the Family, along with Dr. Sandra Bloom and Dr. Ted Corbin. Dr. Sandra Bloom is a psychiatrist and a nationally recognized expert on trauma. She's co-author of Bearing Witness, Violence and Collective Responsibility, among other books. And Dr. Ted Corbin is an assistant professor in the Department of Emergency Medicine at the Drexel University College of Medicine, and he also serves as the medical director of the Healing Hurt Program. And John Rich is professor and chair of health management and policy at the Drexel University School of Public Health. His recent book about urban violence is called Wrong Place, Wrong Time, Trauma and Violence in the Lives of Young Black Men. And thank you all for being here today.
Thank you for having us.
John Rich, let's start with you. How did you first get interested in the lives of these young men? You weren't actually working in the ER when you were at Boston.
No, I wasn't in the emergency department, but in Boston City Hospital, young people who came through the emergency department often ended up in the surgical ward or in primary care clinic where I was trying to care for these patients. And I realized relatively quickly that many of us who were providing care had these assumptions about these patients, that somehow young black men didn't just get shot, they got themselves shot. And I heard it again and again, and as I met a colleague of mine who was a trauma surgeon who began to talk about his frustration with young people coming back again and again, we thought we should talk with young people to think about how we could really convince them to change their lives. In the process of talking to them, doing a systematic research project interviewing them, I realized that many of these young people had suffered tremendous trauma in their lives, not just the trauma of getting shot or stabbed, but many of them had lost friends to violence. Many of them had grown up in homes where parents were absent or drug addicted or incarcerated. And so the accumulative effect of trauma over their lives was playing out in their behaviors in ways that really made sense to them. And we didn't understand it. And so the process of talking to young people actually transformed my understanding about the roots of violence and the really fundamental human problems that these young people are facing.
And Ted Corbin, you are an emergency room physician. So what are your interactions typically like with a young victim who comes in?
Well, primarily, initially, it's really about taking care of their physical wounds, which my colleagues and I in the emergency department do a good job of. But as John was mentioning, the wound is much deeper than the physical wound itself. And so to discharge them back into the community without any additional care really just doesn't seem right. And so that's where we came together through focus groups with other emergency physicians in recognizing that we we really want to do something. We want to provide a service, and we want to collect information about it. But in order to do it, we have to provide a service. And that's when we developed Healing Hurt People.
And Dr. Sandy Bloom, let me ask you, we hear so much about trauma these days, or it seems like we hear a lot, with a lot of soldiers returning from Iraq and Afghanistan. We're talking about post-traumatic stress disorder. Why aren't we talking about this in a setting like the ER, where it seems so natural that there would be trauma?
Exactly. I think we should be talking about it because that we have an urban war zone, and that we're really seeing the young men in the emergency room who have really been victims of that urban war. And it's very much the same thing. They suffer from very similar symptoms that are called post-traumatic stress. But there's a lot of other kinds of problems that people have, both psychologically, socially, and physically, related to trauma that isn't entirely captured in one diagnosis. So we see lots of secondary problems related to, including substance abuse, related to exposure to particularly chronic trauma.
And John, let me return. You hinted that when you were working in Boston, people had a certain attitude toward young victims, that it was in some way their fault. Talk about what really happened to a lot of the young men who you were talking to, who just might have been walking down the street, and maybe also talk a bit about how these attitudes are also played back in the media a lot of times.
Sure. Let me say that all of us who are providing care, for the most part, want to do our best job. But we carry with us stereotypes that come from the media and our own experiences. And the truth is, what's normal for many of these young people is very different from what was normal for us. So the environment that many of these young people grew up in was one where they deeply believe that you have to prove to other people that you're not a sucker. And what that means is that if someone, and young people will tell you this, if someone says something to you or does something, if you don't retaliate, then people will think you're a sucker. And if people think you're a sucker, then other people will take advantage of you. That's their idea. And it's been borne out in their experience that you either fight or people will beat you up. And that really is a function that many of these young people grow up not feeling safe at all. Well, when they don't feel safe, and many of them do not believe that the police will keep them safe, many of them resort to weapons. Now, we know that weapons don't make you safer, but in the environments where these young people grow up, that seems a logical move. And in the context of the trauma that Ted and Sandy are talking about, it seems even more meaningful to them. And so these attitudes that all of us carry as healthcare providers or in the media, all of us are subject to them. And in many ways, they dehumanize these young people. We sort of assume, well, we know them. We saw them on TV. I saw them on a TV show about, you know, inner city Baltimore. So now I know what these young people are about. We don't know them until we have interacted with them and heard their stories and really begun to reach out to them with a healing approach. It actually changes our view of them. But if we don't have that interaction, we won't know them in that way.
And in your book, you also describe that some of the young men felt that they were kind of roughed up in the emergency room just because it is such a hectic environment. So that experience, in addition to being shot, was also very traumatic. Ted, can you kind of set the scene for us, what it's like when a life is at stake and you have to do what you have to do?
Sure. Again, when they come in and they're bleeding or there's a thought to be a gunshot wound or a knife stab wound, the primary thing is to stop the bleeding and control the bleeding and make sure that and resuscitate them appropriately just to make sure that they survive. That's the most important thing. And there are protocols that go along with that in the emergency department, and we work closely with our trauma colleagues as well, just to ensure that they live. So what seems to be somewhat rough, because they haven't been to an emergency department before most of the time, what seems rough really is protocol in an effort to genuinely save their lives.
Right. Do you typically ever get to interact with a person after you've saved them? As a doctor, do you see them again? Do you know how they are doing?
Well, again, it's a team effort between the other physicians, the nurses, and with the work of the program, the team of the program, we are able to interact with them and to see how they've healed physically and then the work that we're doing to help them heal emotionally as well.
Because I would imagine that would be rewarding for a doctor.
Absolutely, in a big way, and so much so that we've allowed some of our patients or clients to come back to our resident doctors, our doctors in training, to talk to them, to see them, to bring the humanity back to them, rather than them just being that protocol or that prototypical person that's in the emergency department that you have to resuscitate.
We're talking about a program that interacts with young victims of violence. It's called Healing Hurt People. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Dr. Sandy Bloom, what are some of the things that people know or do not know about trauma after having been in a violent attack or incident?
I think one of the most important things is that lots of people don't realize that it changes actually changes your biology and the way your brain works, not just emotionally, but it people's arousal level. You know, normally we startle when we hear a loud noise or something scares us, which is normal, but that is not supposed to happen just by hearing a pin drop. But for someone who's experienced a traumatic event, their biology resets itself. Their central nervous system basically resets so that they respond to very, very, very low levels of stimulation with a significant level of arousal, which often is what we call fight or flight. So people are much more ready after a traumatic event, not because they want to be, but because their biology has changed, to respond to very minor provocation with a major, often violent, response based on everything that John and Ted have been saying. And that can make a whole family or a whole neighborhood or a whole city far more dangerous. So the more people, it's called chronic hyperarousal, and the more people you have in any environment that are chronically hyperaroused, the higher the level of violence is going to be, because it takes so little to actually trigger that kind of what really is a defensive response. People are responding with fight. They're not necessarily in flight. That really, I think, is people don't really understand how biologically centered this whole issue is.
And John, the people from Healing Hurt People go in, and one thing you do is you explain to victims that this is how you might be feeling, and this is a normal reaction to the trauma you've experienced. What are the reactions you get from the victims you talk to?
Well, the first thing is, if we don't explain that to them, then they go away. As Ted pointed out, many of these young people don't have much exposure to health care or the medical care system. They go away, and when they start to have nightmares or flashbacks or they're leaping out of their chair at the smallest sound, they think they're going crazy. But what we can do is to simply say, here's what's normal after you've been through a car accident or been stabbed or had any sort of tragic thing happen. You may have these symptoms. They shouldn't stay around for weeks, and if you have troubles, come back and see us. That's often very reassuring to patients to hear that, because when they do go away and they experience some of these things, they can take the advice that we've given them. So we can say, well, you may feel unsafe, but don't go get a weapon. You may have trouble sleeping, but don't smoke marijuana or use drugs to help you with that. Come back and we'll help you through that. And sometimes it's really just the presence of the team that Ted has in place to be a caring adult in the lives of these young people. We don't need medications often to help soothe the wounds of trauma. We need caring adults who say, you know, yeah, you're a little bit different for a while. Let's help you heal, and let's get you connected to some resources that will take advantage of this relatively vulnerable moment in your life, so that if there's some things that you want to accomplish, this doesn't shut you down.
And Sandy Bloom, what happens if these emotions, these feelings after a trauma go unaddressed and untreated?
Well, people still have to adapt to living in the world, so we do the best we can. And unfortunately, many of the methods that people use to adapt end up causing more problems. Like, it's perfectly natural for human beings to have a drink or sedate themselves in some way after a traumatic event. But that is then likely, once that works, it's likely to be repeated and repeated. And that's a kind of a straight end run right to substance abuse problems, just as an example. And there are all kinds of ways that people adapt in positive and negative ways, more often the negative.
We're going to take a short break. You're listening to Voices in the Family, and we're talking about a program today called Healing Hurt People. It comes out of the Center for Nonviolence and Social Justice at Drexel University. Our guests are Dr. Sandy Bloom, Dr. Ted Corbin, and Dr. John Rich. We'll be right back after a short break, and we'll actually hear from one of the young men who has been in your program and who's changed his life after having been shot about a year ago. My name is Mike and Scott. I'm in for Dan Gottlieb today, and you're listening to Voices in the Family here on WHYY.
WHYY is supported by the Cooper Bone and Joint Institute, managing severe orthopedic injury and disease. Their joint replacement program has received the Blue Distinction Award for excellence and quality care. Whether due to arthritis or a severe injury, Cooper physicians precisely align your hip, knee, or shoulder replacement. Tough injuries, skilled physicians. Cooper Bone and Joint Institute. Locations in South Jersey and Newtown Square. CooperHealth.org/numbers or 800-8-COOPER.
Celebrate the Jewish Festival of Lights with Leonard Nimoy and the Western Wind. Join us for a delightful and moving hour of songs sung by the Western Wind and holiday stories told by the inimitable Mr. Spock of Star Trek fame. It's Leonard Nimoy and the Western Wind in Hanukkah and Story and Song from PRI.
Thursday night at 10 on WHYY.
And welcome back to Voices in the Family. I'm Mike and Scott, in for Dan Gottlieb today, and we're talking about a program called Healing Hurt People out of Drexel University's Center for Nonviolence and Social Justice. With us here in the studio are Drs. John Ridge, Dr. Ted Corbin, and Dr. Sandy Bloom. Dr. Sandy Bloom is a psychiatrist and a nationally recognized expert on trauma. She's co-author of Bearing Witness, Violence and Collective Responsibility, among other books. Dr. Ted Corbin is an assistant professor in the Department of Emergency Medicine at Drexel University College of Medicine, and he also serves as the medical director of the Healing Hurt People program. John Ridge is professor and chair of health management and policy at the Drexel University School of Public Health, and his recent book is called Wrong Place, Wrong Time, Trauma and Violence in the Lives of Young Black Men. And before our break, I just wanted to give out the phone number one more time. It is 1-888-477-9499. Again, that number is 1-888-477-9499. If you've had an experience with trauma, work with young people, or a young person yourself, we definitely want to hear from you. And before our break, we were talking a bit about how the Healing Hurt People program work. So, Ted Corbin, where do you operate, and how do you reach out to people, and how do you pick who to reach out to from all the victims?
Sure. We're fortunate to have an amazing team of Dr. Bloom and Dr. Rich. And then we have a research program director, a social worker, and two outreach workers that pretty much work out in the field. They're our community intervention specialists. And we also have colleagues at St. Christopher's Children's Hospital as well. And the idea is really to identify the young person or the person that comes into the emergency department that's been intentionally injured. Again, primarily the most important thing at that point is to stabilize them physically, but at the same time to identify them as a victim of intentional injury, that our social worker is really poised at leaping in, and then our staff, the rest of the emergency department staff, has developed a process where if she's not there, our social worker is not there, then they will in fact tag or somehow let her know that a person is coming overnight so that she can follow up with them within 24 to 48 hours, 24 to 72 hours. There are different components of the program, so the most important part is identifying them, and then our social worker, who's Dion Delgado, again, very amazing, identifies them, and then we do an assessment, really to find out what the needs are for that particular person might be. And it's really important to meet them where they are. It's not a matter of telling them what they should do, utilizing techniques of motivational interviewing and things of the like, really to get them to figure out what they want to do to change. There's another piece, which is the case management and navigation, which is something that our outreach workers do, Lee Jamison and Tony Thompson, who are both, again, really skilled and really committed to doing the work. And they really connect the clients and the patients to the various resources that have been identified in the assessment. We also have something that's really unique that's born out of the work of Dr. Bloom, which is a self group. And the self group really focuses on those four domains, which is an acronym: safety, emotional management, loss, future. And we have those. They're 10-week sessions. It's a 10-week period. They're about an hour and a half. We have two amazing facilitators, Ruth Ann and Joe. And really, this is a space for the young people to talk about those areas: safety, emotional management, loss, and future. And then the last part, which we feel is really important that will help push policy, is where we get together, representing internal medicine, public health, psychiatry, emergency medicine, psychology. Linda Rich, who's also helpful in doing all this work, and Ann Wilson as well. We come together with the intervention specialists and the social worker to really look at where some of the gaps are when we tell the story of this person and realize what has been traumatizing in their lives, what they've experienced, and why they act out in certain ways that some people would see as the wrong way of acting, but really gives it more fabric and context as to why this is happening to them or why they're behaving this way. And we identify these different areas where there are gaps, and really this is how we formulate our policy and policy issues that we want to take to public officials as well. And I also have to mention that Arthur Evans, the Department of Behavioral Health, and the Scattergood Foundation have been really supportive in this work.
And Dr. Sandy Bloom, let me ask you, you mentioned the self groups, Ted Corbin, and is it difficult to get a bunch of young men to come to a group and talk about how do you feel today? I would imagine that can be a challenge.
Well, surprisingly, these men come back, and the kids at St. Christopher's come back, and that is not a typical pattern for group engagement often. But I think the reason is it's very focused on psychoeducation, less about what you feel and more about learning what the ways in which trauma has affected you, and that then is a gateway for people to talk about their own experience. And then, of course, it does get into what I feel and how I'm feeling now. But the focus really is on information and sharing information with peers, which it's not really about an expert telling you what to think or do. It's really about people engaging with each other around terrible things that have happened.
I want us to listen back to an interview I did when I visited the Healing Hurt People program earlier this year. I spoke with a young man, Rob, who had started working with your program after being shot. I think he got shot about probably a year ago now. He's 19 years old, and I talked to him and his caseworker, Tony Thompson, who Ted Corbin mentioned. So let's listen to Rob's story.
I got shot in July, and I got in the program, I say around August, September. What the program did for me was, like, it helped me with a lot of stuff, helped me get back in school. It helps me, like, you know, do everything that I wasn't thinking about, you know, like, far as getting things ready to go to college and, like, things as simple as getting my state ID and, like, my birth certificate and Social Security card. It helped me with a lot.
Can we talk a little bit about when you got shot? Where did you get shot?
I got shot in the top right shoulder. It was over a fist fight, you know, one thing led to another. Some people got their feelings hurt, and they took it to the next level.
And were you hurt badly?
I wasn't hurt as bad as other people was, but if I was 10 pounds lighter, I would have been in a wheelchair. It would have cracked my spine. So, I mean, I was one of the luckier ones to have nothing actually wrong with me, but I do have to live with a bullet in my back.
Could that cause any kind of problems in the long run?
They said I should be okay, but, you know, I get back pains every now and again. I can't do as much as I used to do, you know what I mean, because I had to worry about if the bullet shifts.
And talk about after you got shot, were you mad?
I was pretty pissed after I got shot, but I was more mad at how it happened than it actually happened.
How so?
When the situation was going on, like I said, it was over a fight. You know, I'm kind of from the old school. I got an old spirit, so I'm a fighter. I mean, I don't believe that you got to get a gun to settle situations. I believe we can fist fight and it'll be dropped after that. But I guess people are not thinking that way no more, so that made me more madder than anything.
So what are some things that you learned in this program regarding that feeling of being mad or fighting or all of those things?
I learned that retaliation isn't always the best answer. You can have a lot of emotion, and you can have a lot of anger and all that, but when you act out on them certain things, you erase the future. The more you act out and the more you try and, like, blame people or, you know what I mean, not fully accept it, you take bits and pieces of your life and you throw them away. So it basically just helped me that, it taught me that the calmer you are and the more you focus on your future and the more you focus on just getting past it, the better off you'll be in your life.
Talk about feeling safe. Did you feel safe before you got shot? Did you feel safe after you were shot, given that it happened so quickly?
You know, day by day, you just take it as it is. You still got to live your life, so. But I just noticed, like, little things, like, you know, people staring and things I never paid attention to before, like, you know, just the world, I guess. Things that I tried to block out, you know what I mean, to say, like, it ain't that bad, I notice now.
Since you started coming to the program, you said you went back to school. What happened before with school, and where are you now with that?
Before I got shot, I was in the military school, and I was doing real good. I was excelling. And after I got shot, it was just like my whole mental thing. That's when I start not feeling safe, and I started feeling that type of fear. The people who did it was like near my school, near the school I was going to. So I automatically was like, maybe I should get homeschooled, or you know what I mean? So I tried to take an alternative to better my life, but I ended up messing it up. And like, Mr. Tony came to me, you know what I mean, and I expressed what I wanted to do, you know what I mean, what I was trying to do, but what I couldn't do by myself. And, you know, he helped me out, you know, he straight kept it completely 100% honest with me, and he was like, this is what it is. He was like, but, you know what I mean, I'm not going to put my neck out here for you to just, you know what I mean, walk over it. I mean, you got to be a man of your word, and that's what I am.
So where are you now in school?
I'm a senior. I'll be going to Penn State in August. I'm doing real good right now so far, you know. I had a real, real tough time growing up. And I feel like it's a lot of people in my situation, you know what I mean? From what they experienced coming up, they take the wrong path. And after I got shot, I became one of them people who just was going to the negative side. And like I said, Mr. Tony was one of them people who I leaned on to help me get back on the right path.
When did you first meet Rob?
I met Robert in mid-December, mid to late December. Robert was already in the program. I had just started, and I saw the potential in Robert, so I've just supported him. It's a deep relationship because we've had this bond and this rapport. So I'm very proud of him, extremely proud, and I see nothing but the sky's the limit for Robert.
So what happens when he goes off to college? Does that mean?
No. Actually, I'm going to be at the graduation. I'll be at his college graduation, and I'll be there the first day he goes to school. So I've already put a time aside so I can take him up to Penn State and be there with him while he transitions over.
And that voice you just heard was Tony Thompson. He's a community intervention specialist for healing hurt people. And we heard also from a young man who Tony works with. His name is Rob. And Dr. Ted Corbin, give us an update on Rob. How is he doing now?
Robert is doing really well. He participated in a project that we had take place at the university this past week. And he'll be going off to Pennsylvania College of Technology, which is a subsidiary connected to the Penn State University. So Robert's doing really well, and we're very happy that Tony's been able to help navigate him to the resources that he would benefit from.
Rob talked a bit about, after the incident, being scared at the school and then trying to find a new situation. Can you venture a guess what might have happened to Rob had Tony not been there, had the program not been there to kind of catch him?
Well, certainly what he was describing is that hyper arousal that Dr. Bloom was talking about earlier. So things that seemed, you know, insignificant to him before now suddenly made him feel really unsafe. And young people who feel really unsafe often try and take things into their own hands. So while I can't speak, I think that, you know, Robert has some strengths there. It's possible that other young people who have experienced this might, first of all, stop going to school altogether, avoid the circumstance, or might decide that the only way they can be safe is to have a weapon. And again, that's a setup for another violent episode that without this perspective, without this trauma-informed perspective, we wouldn't really understand, and so our remedies wouldn't be as specific as healing hurt people is to the issue of trauma.
And Dr. Sandy Bloom, we hear a bit these days about something called post-traumatic growth, and that is when people really, after a traumatic incident, seem to grow personally. So can a moment like this be, for lack of better terms, a blessing in disguise? Can it lead to learning?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's part of what we're trying to do with the program, is that provide more pathways that make that more possible. But it's not, I don't want people leaving to think that it's, that you could just get past it, or that it just, you can undo it, or that it has no effect. It's more about changing somebody's trajectory afterward and making sure that you bank the odds that the adaptations they make to it will be positive and lead them on a path of growth rather than negative and lead them to what's called reenact, repeat the past over and over.
And I want to talk a little bit also about resilience. Rob mentioned that he had had a very difficult childhood, and I also talked to Tony a bit, who emphasized just how bad his life had been. And all in all, he seemed like a very resilient young person despite everything. So how do you talk about the resilience in the young people you interact with, and also how you foster that once you start working with them?
Well, these young people often possess a lot of strength. Some of it has been their adaptation to really difficult circumstances. And some young people have been forced to assume an adult role. And so they are really quite thoughtful in many ways. And the truth is that when we interact with these young people, we find that most of them have tremendous strengths. There's this idea out there, again, the stereotype about these young people is that they're hard and mean and aggressive. The truth is, their emotions are very close to the surface. And so somewhere there have been, in many cases, some supportive adult who's helped them. Some have been able to adapt to difficult circumstances. But part of it is how one approaches them, with an assumption that these young people have strength, an assumption that the trauma that they've experienced has done some harm, but that they have the potential to, number one, identify opportunities for change, and also to engage their feelings so that they can heal. I think that's an assumption that's really important to bring to the work.
Let me get a caller in at 1-888-477-9499. Again, that's 1-888-477-9499. We have Dr. Jackson on the phone. Hi, you're on Voices in the Family.
Hi, my name's Christina, and I am a nurse practitioner, and I teach nursing students. And I just wanted to share some ideas to kind of piggyback on what Dr. Ted had said about emergency rooms being traumatic places in and of themselves. And I think that staff in settings like emergency rooms need to mitigate rather than extend trauma. And it doesn't take much time. I think that I teach nurses and physicians to use eye contact, loving touch, you know, caring moments, the way they touch somebody, the way they approach somebody, giving a warm blanket, even monitoring noise levels, having soothing ambient music, you know, being aware of all of the sensory input in emergency room settings. And I think that in order to do this, nurses and physicians need to take care of themselves as body, mind, spirit, whole, so they can offer that care to the patients who come in.
Yeah, that you bring up a good point there, and that's something, is it sometimes maybe easier for somebody who works in such a traumatic surrounding as an emergency room to kind of think of the victim as a certain person, just to think, well, that is not going to happen to me because I'm not that person. So is it easier to keep people at arm's length, so to say, Ted?
Well, I would have to say that we all have to have a certain level of guard up. Because seeing injuries and emergencies on a regular basis really does, it does something to you. And then there's the vicarious trauma that occurs as well. And I think what the caller brings up is extremely important. But I think, and our staff is really poised to work diligently and the best that they can in given the circumstances and the speed that everything has to happen. So I think the addition of our team really does help provide that caring environment, that holistic environment that approaches the person as a whole.
And Dr. Bloom, do physicians tend to talk about trauma themselves, maybe the trauma in their own life?
I don't think we pay nearly as much attention as we need to our own experience of working with people who are very hurt, very injured. And so it often, I think, physicians do become pretty numb, emotionally numb, to the impact that the environment and their behavior has on their on the patients. And I think the caller is very right that the more we can focus on that, the better it makes treatment outcomes for everybody.
And John Rich, I want to return before we started talking again about the emergency room environment. We were talking about Rob, who at this point in his life seems to be doing great. I'm sure not every story has a happy ending. In your book, for example, Wrong Place, Wrong Time, you profiled several young men. Not all of them ended up doing great. One of them was in jail by the time the book was done. So talk a bit about that.
Sure. We know that the life experiences of a lot of these young people have been so profound that they haven't had supportive adults in their lives to guide them and help them make decisions that make sense, that some of them will end up getting incarcerated. Some may end up injured so badly that they lose real function, so they may be wheelchair confined. But I think that this, all of this information about trauma simply tells us that many of the people who are incarcerated have experienced extreme trauma in their lives. What we could do to help them heal while they are incarcerated would be to provide these critical supports and services, the kinds of self-group work that's happening in healing hurt people. I think the assumption is that when people are incarcerated, that they're lost. And when budget times get tight, we often slash services in prison. So behavioral health often gets cut out. We would argue, and this perspective would argue, that that's exactly what we ought to be doing to help people emerge and be successful. So even the young people who end up in jail, it's not lost for them. But it depends on what that experience is, because jail itself can simply compound their trauma and make them angrier and less functional when they come out. So if we care about how people come out, then bringing trauma care to people, even in those circumstances where they seem to have gone off the track, might be our best bet.
I want to take another short break. We're talking about a program today that's called Healing Hurt People. It's run out of Drexel University's Center for Nonviolence and Social Justice. And joining us in the studio are John Rich, Dr. Ted Corbin, and Dr. Sandy Bloom. Sandy Bloom is a psychiatrist and a nationally recognized expert on trauma. Dr. Ted Corbin is the medical director of Healing Hurt People, and Dr. John Rich is a professor at Drexel University School of Public Health and has written Wrong Place, Wrong Time, Trauma and Violence in the Lives of Young Black Men. We'll be right back after a short break. I'm Mike and Scott, in for Dan Gottlieb today, and you're listening to Voices in the Family here on WHYY-FM.
Penn Medicine supports WHYY. Doctors at Penn's Depression Research Unit have been studying the causes and treatment of mood disorders since 1964 and are currently performing research to develop improved treatments. Symptoms may include mood swings, low energy, and low motivation. Initial evaluations are offered to determine those who are eligible for treatment. More about Penn's Depression Research Unit at 215-662-3462. 215-662-3462.
The Delaware Theater Company presents Around the World in 80 Days, December 1st through the 19th. This theatrical journey follows Phileas Fogg and A Servant Passepartout as they set out to beat the clock in a race around the globe. Five actors portray 39 characters in Mark Brown's imaginative adaptation of Jules Verne's century-old comic novel, directed by Aaron Posner. For tickets to Around the World, 302-594-1100 or DelawareTheater.org. The Delaware Theater Company supports WHYY.
And
And welcome back to Voices in the Family. I'm Mike and Scott, in for Dan Gottlieb today. We're talking about a program called Healing Hurt People out of Drexel University's Center for Nonviolence and Social Justice. In the studio with me are Drs. John Ridge, Ted Corbin, and Sandy Bloom. Sandy Bloom is a psychiatrist and nationally recognized expert on trauma. Ted Corbin is an assistant professor in the Department of Emergency Medicine at the Drexel University College of Medicine, and he serves as the medical director of the Healing Hurt People program. And John Ridge is professor and chair of health management and policy at the Drexel University School of Public Health. And before our break, we're talking about some of the ongoing challenges that these young victims face in their lives, even if they are fortunate enough to be enrolled in a program. And when I came to visit the program, Healing Hurt People, a while back, I also met a young man named Hector. He's 17 and he lives in Northeast Philadelphia. He had been shot in the hand and then was working with a caseworker named Lee Jameson. And she works out of St. Chris's Hospital. And actually, one of the issues that Hector had identified in his life was that he really didn't like his school. He wasn't excelling there. There was a lot of violence at his school. So Lee was trying to help him change schools and had set up an interview for him at a new school that was very important to Hector's life. And then on the eve of that interview, somebody got shot, and I want to talk about that and play that clip. When I was talking to Hector, I noticed he was wearing a jacket, and on the back of his jacket, somebody was memorialized. So I saw that, and I asked him what it said on the back of his jacket. So let's hear that clip.
It said R.I.P. Dwayne, because he got shot right up the street from my house. Just like him, he was the wrong place at the wrong time. People came up to him and shot him up.
How old was he?
He was 17.
Was he your best friend?
Yeah, he was sort of like my cousin, because in school he looked out for me, like for like bullies and stuff, he looked out for me.
So how did you deal with his death and the sadness and the madness of it?
I don't know. I was crying a lot. Every day I was crying, but I had to stop crying. I just stopped thinking sometimes and stuff. Like, I still cry sometimes, but he can't come back, so I might as well keep it in my heart.
It happened, actually. I remember it happened the day you went for that interview. I remember he got into my car, and I could tell that he looked really upset. And so I asked him what was wrong, and he told me that his friend had died. I think I asked him, or I asked him if he still wanted to go to the interview, and I was really surprised that he said yes. So we went and we did that.
Do you remember why you decided to go to the interview?
Don't stop, because somebody died. It was a little hard, though. So I just said, let's go do this, get it over with.
And you got through it okay?
Yes.
I think you actually made everybody in the interview laugh at one point.
And that's the thing about Hector. Before he told me this story, we were actually laughing quite a bit during the interview, because he's funny, and he seems just like every other kid who's 17, and then he tells you something like that and just makes you stop. Is that an experience you have when interacting with these young folks?
I think so. I think that they're often very surprising, given what they've been through, how they have the ability to sometimes manage their emotions and to be really authentic with their emotions. So Hector talks about how he cried. We often think, well, a young man would never admit to crying because that's not masculine and manly. But he really, I think, is able to touch those feelings and to, with the help of someone in his life, to manage them. And that's really part of the goal, is to help young people figure out ways to manage these normal emotions and to be authentic and acknowledge them.
Dr. Bloom, how does ongoing violence in communities contribute to this problem, and how does it re-traumatize people after you've had an experience and then you're working on getting over that and then somebody else gets shot and killed in this case?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it triggers that whole sequence of chronic hyperarousal again, because you can't be safe. And where can you be safe? If you can't be safe on your own streets, then how can you be safe anywhere? And I think it is way bigger a problem than we're really paying attention to. It is, for me, and I think for us, the biggest public health issue that we have facing us as a country, is that there are so many children that are being exposed to violence. And the Department of Justice statistics on that pretty much confirm what we're talking about. It's a huge problem.
And talk a bit how that moment in Hector's life could have derailed everything that had so far been working out for him, Ted.
Well, I mean, it could have easily. I mean, I don't know that I could have gone to the interview after experiencing something like that. But he was able to go through, and he had been going to the self groups and the support of a caring adult involved in his life, and he actually did get into that school that he was interviewing for. And I have to say, Hector's doing well. But again, it's a process. It's an ongoing process of managing his emotions, dealing with loss, having a future, and feeling safe.
So talk a bit, how can a program like yours make a difference? Does it sometimes feel like a drop in the bucket?
Well, this program is part of a larger perspective. These young people come in most emergency departments across the country, when a young person comes in who's been shot or stabbed or beaten up, their physical wounds are treated and nothing else happens. That's the vast majority. And we have to acknowledge that there's more happening there. And when they come through our doors, whether it's emergency department or primary care, we have a responsibility to take care of this, not just their physical bodies, but their minds. And we feel a special particular responsibility. Many of these young people, to be honest, look like us. And so we feel a particular burden to make sure that that they're seen as human, that they're seen as deserving of this, and that we do something that we know is based on the science. We know that trauma affects the lives, the bodies, the minds of young people. We believe that they have strength. How can we, in that moment, make a difference? And so we're trying to demonstrate that it can be done and that it ought to be done.
And are you talking to other doctors, to other hospitals around the country? And if so, what are they saying?
We definitely are. We are a part of a national network of hospital-based intervention programs who share the same framework in some ways. The theory is somewhat different in that we're coming from a trauma-informed perspective. And that's something that we're hoping to infuse into some of the other programs across the country. But again, you can count the number of programs that are in existence. But again, it's something that we're looking forward to demonstrate is from what we see, it's a promising practice. But we're looking for ways to demonstrate that it does, in fact, have a difference or make a difference in the lives of young people.
And Sandy, talk about taking this approach outside of the hospital. Is there things that can be learned from what you're doing with this program that can be done in communities and in other settings?
Yes, I think the most important thing to be learned is that it doesn't take that much. That it takes a relationship with another human being that cares to really change the life of a young person. And all the studies that we have supports that it doesn't take major, even mental health intervention for most people. Kids need somebody that cares about them and that will be there for them. So when Tony says, I will be there for him throughout the good times and the bad, that makes a difference in any of our lives. And these kids are no different than anybody else.
What are some other settings where there are natural points of connection?
Schools, definitely. We have to do something about the violence in our schools. It's unacceptable. And kids who are the most vulnerable are kids who are being raised in places where there's a lot of community violence. So we need to address that. Community centers, sports teams, anywhere where you can have contact with a young person. If you're an adult, you can do something. You can do something to change that kid's life for the better.
And how many people do you work with typically, and is there any hope of expanding to do more in Philadelphia and surrounding cities?
Well, I think that the goal, caseworkers can handle a certain number of cases. I think that at, for example, Hahnemann, there's about one person a day who comes in as a victim. Within the age range that the program focuses on, we sort of 16 to 30 in that setting, younger at the children's hospital, the case managers can handle about 20 to 25 clients at any given time. we are working to expand the resources to be able to serve more young people and to refine the technique so that we can teach others how to do it. I do want to add one quick thing, and that is that when we talk about engagement of a caring adult in the life of a young person, it has to be a long-term engagement. We have sometimes wanted quick fixes, but as Ted and Sandy have talked about, it really requires a long-term perspective in order to help these young people. And Healing Hurt People has partnered as well with resources in case the young person has really, really, really severe symptoms. We have a colleague, Dr. Steve Berkowitz, who has a particular intervention for the parent and the child together for those kids who are really struggling. And so there are various different levels at which this works, but it requires a long-term healing commitment that may start in the emergency department but extend into the school, into the community, and then into the families of these young people.
And no one strike and you're out approach either. Like, you have to be there, I guess, for...
Absolutely, because that is actually part of the trauma in the lives of many of these young people, is they have not had a consistent presence with integrity to demonstrate to them that what you say is what it is. And that's actually what Rob said about Tony. He said, you know, it's a guy who basically tells you something and you know that it's true. That's a really powerful example.
And with that, we're going to have to close. I want to thank all three of you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Our pleasure.
My guests today have been Dr. Sandra Bloom, Ted Corbin, and John Rich. They are all part of the Healing Hurt People program at the Center for Nonviolence and Social Justice at Drexel University. Bloom is a psychiatrist and nationally recognized expert on trauma. Corbin is an emergency room physician and assistant professor in the Department of Emergency Medicine at Drexel University College of Medicine. Rich is chair of health management and policy at the Drexel University School of Public Health, and he's written Wrong Place, Wrong Time, Trauma and Violence in the Lives of Young Black Men. You can find more information on this program on our website, whyy.org/voices. Next week, Dr. Dan Gottlieb is back, and we'll discuss the effects children have on life satisfaction in parents and how parents can work through difficulties. If you have a question, a show idea, or a comment, please email us at voices@whyy.org. You can listen to archive editions of Voices in the Family on our website, whyy.org/voices. The engineer for today's show has been Fred Snyder. Elizabeth Paris Luna is executive producer for audio content for WHYY. Evan Pliss is our intern. Our producer is Jennifer Lynn. I'm Mike and Scott, behavioral health reporter for WHYY. Dan is back next week. Thank you so much for listening.